Mark Levin here. See you this afternoon at 3 on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
It's 5:35 here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Kirby in for John on this beautiful Friday, May 31st, Clint Eastwood's birthday. There's a new book out by writer for National Review, and of course I've been a fan of National Review for a long time. I read my first National Review when I was 14, and I've been a fan of the magazine for a long time. I read it, the online form, probably check it 6 times a day. Their blog, The Corner's incredible. One of the writers, Kevin Williamson, who writes a blog called The Exchequer, dealing with financial matters and government debt and all those depressing things. He's written a couple books in the past, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism. His new book is The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. And it's an awesome book, and he joins us now. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. Kevin, The End is Near. $17 trillion national debt, $100 trillion here, $100 trillion there. When the end comes, what do you expect it to be like? Do you expect us all to wake up one day and find the banks closed, the government shuttered, our paychecks no good, our ATM cards not working? Or is there going to be a 3-4 month period? Or how do you see it when the end hits? What's it like?
Well, I think that's really the challenge from here going forward, is to avoid that scenario and to ensure that the changes that we're facing will be relatively smooth and happen over a long period of time and are non-disruptive. But they could happen that way. You know, I mean, that's what we really need to be pressing government on right now, is to just admit the fact that we've got these debts and liabilities that can't be paid. I mean, they just simply, mathematically speaking, can't be paid. That doesn't mean we're going to default on the debt. But it means that all the promises for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and things like that are going to have to be revisited. And pretty much all other government spending is going to have to be revisited as well. So if we get on top of that and get on top of it pretty quickly, we have a really good chance of getting through it without it being something that's really anarchic and disastrous. But if we don't, yeah, it could very well do that. I mean, the most likely scenario is you see interest rates go back up to something like their historical average, and suddenly you've got an extra trillion or trillion and a half dollars in spending just on debt service, and then you get a collapse in the federal budget and everything that comes after that. I don't think that's where we're headed, and I certainly hope that's not where we're headed, but avoiding that is really the thing we have to keep foremost in our minds right now.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in the book that I found insightful and actually commonsensical to some of us is that the market responds to failure. That is, you mentioned things like the new Coke, Betamax. When these things fail, they disappear rapidly, replaced by superior products. There's a certain element of competition, and the consumer is king. And if you don't like new Coke, it dies. Yet with government, they're stuck in this thinking that a system once starts, a program once started, continues. Social Security, for instance, which we know is not viable, is still there, and they're trying to prop it up rather than change it. And that this fundamental difference in thinking is what makes government so much different than the market. Government just can't change or change a little, whereas the market is dynamic and changes all the time.
Yeah, it's analogous to evolution in a sense that, you know, companies, they have ideas about things and they try them out, but nobody really knows. And the new Coke thing to me is really interesting because everyone assumes corporations are really, really powerful, but of course consumers have all the real power in the market. You know, Coke is one of the biggest companies in the world, had at the time the largest advertising budget in the world, enormous marketing power, best distribution system in the world, probably still has that. But when they put something out that people don't like, people don't buy it, and there's nothing they can do to force them to do it. You know, we get little improvements in things over time, which is why an iPhone is so much better than a 1985 two-pound Motorola brick phone. We take those advancements as though they're just a natural thing, as though they just happen on their own spontaneously. They don't. What we have, not just in the for-profit sector, but elsewhere in society, is people constantly conducting little experiments. Can I make this thing a little bit better? Can I make this thing a little bit better? And over time, those things really add up. You know, you take a cheap car today, like a Honda Civic. You know, that's a car you get in your first car out of college, something like that, something you might even buy for your college student. You know, it's a better car than anything you could buy in 1955, better than a Ferrari that was made then, better than a Rolls-Royce that was made then. But we've got things like Social Security, which is a 1935 product that just has never been improved on because government, the way it works is, well, let's do this one time, and then that problem is solved, at least we'll pretend like it's solved. whether it's immigration or guns or healthcare, you know, pass one big law every generation, and that's going to fix it rather than experimenting on a day-by-day basis.
Is that something you believe inherent in government, that it just simply can't do this? Or is there something about the state of mind of the people that run government, like denial, that if changed, we could make government better? Or are we just stuck with the fact government will never be as innovative, creative, dynamic, and subject to change as, say, the market?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's not really so much a moral problem or an ideological problem as it is a simple information management problem. You know, you look at something that's happening in the marketplace, something that's happening on a collaborative project like Wikipedia. You've got millions and millions of people, each with little pieces of knowledge about how to go about solving a particular problem. And markets and other voluntary systems allow people to organize that information in a way that's really effective. Government bureaucracies, even if they're staffed with the best and smartest people, which they aren't, we all have to admit that, they really aren't, but even if they were, they simply don't have the aggregate thinking power of millions and millions or billions of people working in the market, working in cooperative ways to solve problems.
Now, the subtitle of your book is How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. And ultimately, your belief is that the failure of government will leave, as I read it, will leave the American people free out of necessity or choice to find better solutions for, you know, social welfare, for education. They'll be more localized. There'll be more input from people. There'll be better systems because we will have learned how the big systems don't work. But in the beginning, recipients of government aid, recipients of welfare, Social Security, government employees, they won't be so happy, will they, when their benefits aren't coming, their paychecks aren't being cashed, and they're kind of on their own after being dependent on government for decades?
Yeah, I mean, the real problem isn't going to come, I think, so much from people who receive, say, welfare benefits, although they're going to be unhappy to lose those. The real resistance is going to be from people who are employed by the government or who are employed by firms that are government contractors, whether it's in things like defense. Or, you know, a lot of welfare is actually contracted out to private companies that charge the government, you know, X rate for doing things. And those are really high-paying jobs. You know, you find executives in these businesses making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year, and they are not going to go gently. They're going to be the ones that we really, really have to fight. And, you know, I think that's actually been a good outcome of the sequester. You know, everyone's talking about, oh, my gosh, the sequester is going to ruin the economy and people are going to be unhappy. No one's complaining about it except for government contractors in D.C. and Northern Virginia.
Right.
And, well, get used to it because there are going to be more complaints coming.
Now, do we have people in government who are smart enough to manage this decline, if you will? Because it's obviously coming, and even though a lot of people deny it, either because they can't see it or don't want to see it, if this is, I understand your point, if it's managed properly, we can ease the pain and shift to this new emphasis on smaller, decentralized, more market-oriented solutions to a lot of these problems. But if the people aren't smart enough to run the system and plan the system work in the beginning, are they smart enough to manage the decline in such a way that they can minimize the pain and the agony and the disruption?
You know, I have a fair degree of optimism about that. I don't, not so much in the government itself, but in the American people who vote badly, but they aren't stupid. And, you know, I've spent time, you know, in the last couple of weeks with, you know, Paul Ryan, Rand Paul, some of these people, and they kind of get it. You know, they get where things are going. And I think it's going to just, for them, be a question of drawing up priorities. So when the crunch really hits, you start asking your questions like, well, we never really wanted to means test Social Security, but do we have to write Bill Gates a check every month? Do we have to write Warren Buffett a check every month? Well, okay, if we don't do that, what about people who are worth $100 million? What about people who are worth $10 million? You get a more sensible system that way. You start making priority decisions. And then you start saying things like, well, do we really need this Cowboy Poets Festival in Nevada, or should we have a military and police force? You know, and you start making those kinds of decisions, and I think that you can, over a period of time, get to a more sensible place.
We're talking with Kevin Williamson. He writes for National Review. He runs the Exchequer blog on The Corner. If you go to National Review online, you'll find that. He also writes on The Corner. He also writes articles. His new book is called The End Is Near. It's going to be awesome, How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. Kevin, we have to take a short break. We'll come back. More questions for you in the book, so please hold on. We're back with Kevin right after this. This is Kirby and for John on Talk Radio 570 KVI. It's 544.
We've got to stick together. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Beautiful friend. Oh yeah, I know. The Doors. The End.
This is the end.
548, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Very appropriate bumper music for talking with Kevin Williamson, National Review, the author of the new book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. By the way, there's a link to Kevin's book on our Facebook page, 570 KVI. You should read this book, because what I like about this book is that despite the fact that it's doom and gloom, the end is coming, Kevin's very optimistic about your ability and my ability as Americans to learn from this and come out of it better, in fact, richer, happier, and more secure. Kevin, before we get back to your book, I'd like to talk about an incident recently in your life that you wrote about in National Review that made you a national stud, and the subject of some controversy about rude people in theaters. You were at a theater recently with a date, and a young woman next to you insisted on using her cell phone despite being urged not to by the ushers and the officials.
Yeah, of all the things I've done and written in life, this seems to be the one that's getting the most attention for whatever reason. So yeah, I'm a theater critic as well. I write the theater column for the New Criterion. Uh-huh. So I was there, you know, working, and I didn't have to date along that night. Yeah, it's this obnoxious lady next to me, just, you know, texting all the way through. Pretty good play, incidentally. And it was really annoying, you know, asked her to stop, she wouldn't stop, asked her again, that kind of thing. And finally, I just kind of got fed up with it, so I took the cell phone out of her hands and I threw it out the door.
And I understand that you got applauded by many people who are apparently also possibly in trouble. Have they set up a legal defense fund for you yet?
Well, there was talk of charges, but no one's actually filed any charges yet.
That's good.
So that's good.
You did what I think so many people would love to do. And that's what I think makes it so unique, because I think we've all been in theaters, be it movies or plays, or places where cell phones aren't supposed to be used, and some people are so addicted they simply can't leave it for 3 hours. I don't understand why you pay mucho bucos to go to a baseball game or a play so you can play with your iPhone. I don't understand that.
Yeah, that's, you know, the thing that I always keep in mind is that, you know, I'm usually at these things for free, you know, because I'm a critic, but this was a $175 ticket.
Yeah.
For this thing. So if you brought a date and parked, you're talking about a $500 night before you even go to see dinner. And that's just, you know, it's absurd for people to behave that way. So, I took the law into my own hands there a little bit.
That's
okay. I'm glad I did.
I'm glad you did, too. I think it was a great thing to do, and hopefully she learned something from it, although some of our young people don't seem to learn much at all about anything. And before we get back to the book, one of your other books, you wrote The Politically Correct Guide to Socialism, which I've read and truly enjoyed, and I would urge people to consider that book as well. Is Barack Obama a socialist?
Yeah, in the sense that he believes in government planning of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's a self-conscious Marxist or anything like that. I mean, he probably was in college because it was very fashionable back in the 1980s. But, you know, if he were a member of an English political party, he'd be a member of a forthrightly socialist political party like Labour, or if he was a member of another European political party, he'd be a member of some forthrightly socialist party like Hollande's party in France, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's certainly where he is. I mean, what Obama is an Obamaist. You know, his main belief is in the goodness and intellectual superiority of Barack Obama and people who admire Barack Obama, and that in a sense is even more dangerous than people who are, you know, doctrinaire believers in particular kinds of political philosophies. Because if you've noticed, the thing about the Obama administration, it's been very ad hoc. They just sort of make stuff up as they go along. Yeah. They don't have any sort of, you know, philosophical or intellectual guidelines, really, other than what the president thinks is right because he thinks he's the smartest guy he knows. And that's it's a dangerous way to go about governing. You know, it's weird that he's so far to the left, but also in some ways far to the right of where the Bush administration was before him. You know, Cheney never thought about killing U.S. citizens.
That's right.
I mean, never would have crossed his mind. Well, it might have crossed his mind, but he certainly wouldn't have talked about it in public, I think, much less pursued it as a policy, much less leaked to the New York Times who he was going to kill so he can look like a tough guy.
Right.
You know, that's a really worrisome thing. You get the worst of both worlds in a guy like this.
Or gone after journalists in the name of national security.
Yeah.
Like James Rosen. Yeah.
Yeah, that's bad stuff. And the AP stuff is worrisome. You know, when you're busting people for leaking information that you were planning on leaking yourself just because they don't want to follow your PR schedule.
Yeah.
You know, that's nuts. I mean, I'm sort of two minds about that because Washington abuses classification. You know, they classify too much stuff. It's legitimate to prosecute people for tricking in classified material, but if they were going to do that on any sort of consistent basis, they'd have to arrest every reporter in Washington, D.C., and half of us in New York, because we all get classified stuff because they classify everything.
That's right. And then you have an attorney general who signed off on the warrant, but then publicly said he would never get to be involved in such a policy and they had never even heard of such a policy. So you have this memory deficiency among people in government. That's dangerous as well, because if you don't remember what you're doing. Anyway, it boggles the mind, but the American public elected him, so they get what they deserve. Back to the book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. There is this sense of optimism in this book, which is one of the reasons I like about it, because you do have this inherent faith in the good sense of the American people to finally come around and realize that this is an issue. Do you see it as being kind of a combination of one day we wake up and realize we have to reform entitlements, like you say, Bill Gates shouldn't get a Social Security check. We have to do away with some of the programs like Obamacare and lower people's expectations, and at the same time promote policies of economic growth so that people can have more of their own, we can get better jobs opportunities, and this transition will naturally occur?
Yeah, I don't think we should lower people's expectations. I think we should raise their expectations. You know, with a proper pension system, a proper healthcare financing system, real voluntary cooperative market-augmented ways of doing this, you're going to get much nicer retirements than we've had in the past. You know, Social Security is a terrible way to live if that's all you've got. I mean, it's awful. Medicare is not very good. Medicaid is terrible. So we're not losing anything that's of a great deal of value, I don't think. And you replace those with real productive systems that are driven by assets, that are driven by investment, that are driven by innovation in the marketplace, and you're going to get things that, you know, make what we have right now look like what a telephone looked like in 1935, what a car looked like in 1935. You know, this stuff is primitive, but we still got these old-fashioned ways of doing these very important things. Education is really the one that that keeps me up at night, because I think that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why I have a whole lot I've written here and elsewhere about homeschooling, which I think is a really good example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Now, I don't think homeschooling's right for everybody. I don't think there's one way of doing anything that's right for everybody. But homeschooling is a good example of people saying, you know what, we've got this problem where not only are our schools expensive and they tax us too much and they waste money, but they also don't do the thing that we want them to do, which is give good educations to our kids. So regardless of whether you're actually going to take our money and take our taxes, you're not going to get our kids. And we can do this ourselves. So you get an interesting thing going on there. You've got families doing their own thing. You get communities of homeschoolers coming up with cooperative ways of doing things together. And then you also have the market stepping in, where companies are coming up with curriculums and educational materials and other sorts of products and supplemental sources for people who are educating their own kids.
Right.
So you end up with this thing that works the same way as the rest of the economy does, where you've got this distributed system of lots of people trying out lots of things, and consumers and producers interacting in the marketplace, people cooperating on their own terms, and it works really well.
For what it's worth, I teach homeschoolers in homeschool co-ops the past 14 years, history in American government economics, and I agree with you. It's an incredible system. The market's responded, and the kids are pretty well educated, but I'm biased. Kevin Williamson, National Review, author of The End is Near, is going to be awesome. That book is at our Facebook page on 570 KVI. Kevin, great book, great job, big fan. Please say hello to Jack and Rich if you get a chance. I'm good friends with them. Tell them Kirby said hi.
Will do.
All right, thank you, Kevin, very much.
Thank you.
Best of luck. You bet. We're going to be right back after the news. It's 5:57.